Europe and the United States. Unsurprisingly, the shocks of the 1914 to 1945 period affected Europe much more strongly, so that the capital-income ratio was lower there from the 1920s into the 1980s. If we accept this lengthy period of war and its aftermath, however, we find that the capital-income ratio has always tended to be higher in Europe. This was true in the 19th and early 20th centuries, when the capital-income ratio was 6 to 7 in Europe, compared with 4 to 5 in the United States. And again, in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, private wealth in Europe again surpassed U.S. levels in the early 1990s, and the capital-income ratio there is close to 6 today, compared with slightly more than 4 in the United States. See PDF figures 5.1 and 5.2. These facts remain to be explained. Why did the capital-income ratio return to historical highs in Europe, and why should it be structurally higher in Europe than in the United States? What magical forces imply that capital in one society should be worth 6 or 7 years of national income rather than 3 or 4? Is there an equilibrium level for the capital-income ratio? And if so, how is it determined? What are the consequences for the rate of return on capital, and what is the relation between it and the capital-labor split of national income? To answer these questions, I will begin by presenting the dynamic law that allows us to relate the capital-income ratio in an economy to its savings and growth rates. The second fundamental law of capitalism. Beta equals S divided by G. In the long run, the capital-income ratio, beta, is related in a simple and transparent way to the savings rate, S, and the growth rate, G, according to the following formula. Beta equals savings divided by growth rate. For example, if S equals 12% and G equals 2%, then beta equals S divided by G equals 600%. In other words, if a country saves 12% of its national income every year, and the rate of growth of its national income is 2% per year, then in the long run, the capital-income ratio will be equal to 600%. The country will have accumulated capital worth 6 years of national income. This formula, which can be regarded as the second fundamental law of capitalism, reflects an obvious but important point. A country that saves a lot and grows slowly will, over the long run, accumulate an enormous stock of capital relative to its income, which can in turn have a significant effect on the social structure and distribution of wealth. Let me put it another way. In a quasi-stagnant society, wealth accumulated in the past will inevitably acquire disproportionate importance. The return to a structurally high capital-income ratio in the 21st century, close to the levels observed in the 18th and 19th centuries, can therefore be explained by the return to a slow growth regime. Decreased growth, especially demographic growth, is thus responsible for capital's comeback. The basic point is that small variations in the rate of growth can have very large effects on the capital-income ratio over the long run. For example, given a savings rate of 12%, if the rate of growth falls to 1.5% a year instead of 2%, then the long-term capital-income ratio, beta equals S divided by G, will rise to 8 years of national income instead of 6. If the growth rate falls to 1%, then beta equals S divided by G will rise to 12 years, indicative of a society twice as capital-intensive as when the growth rate was 2%. In one respect, this is good news. Capital is potentially useful to everyone, and provided that things are properly organized, everyone can benefit from it. In another respect, however, what this means is that the owners of capital, for a given distribution of wealth, potentially control a larger share of total economic resources. In any event, the economic, social, and political repercussions of such a change are considerable. On the other hand, if the growth rate increases to 3%, then beta equals S divided by G will fall to just 4 years of national income. If the savings rate simultaneously decreases slightly to S equals 9%, then the long-run capital income ratio will decline to 3. These effects are all the more significant because the growth rate that figures in the law, beta equals S divided by G, is the overall rate of growth of national income. That is, the sum of the per capita growth rate and the population growth rate. In other words, for a savings rate on the order of 10 to 12% and a growth rate of national income per capita on the order of 1.5 to 2% a year, it follows immediately that a country that has near zero demographic growth and therefore a total growth rate close to 1.5 to 2%, as in Europe, can expect to accumulate a capital stock worth 6 to 8 years of national income, whereas a country with demographic growth on the order of 1% a year, and therefore a total growth rate of 2.5 to 3%, as in the United States, will accumulate a capital stock worth only 3 to 4 years of national income. And if the latter country tends to save a little less than the former, perhaps because its population is not aging as rapidly, this mechanism will be further reinforced as a result. In other words, countries with similar growth rates of income per capita can end up with very different capital income ratios, simply because their demographic growth rates are not the same. This law allows us to give a good account of the historical evolution of the capital income ratio. In particular, it enables us to explain why the capital income ratio seems now, after the shocks of 1914 to 1945, and the exceptionally rapid growth phase of the second half of the 20th century, to be returning to very high levels. It also enables us to understand why Europe tends, for structural reasons, to accumulate more capital than the United States, or at any rate will tend to do so as long as the U.S. demographic growth rate remains higher than the European, which probably will not be forever. But before I can explain this phenomenon, I must make several conceptual and theoretical points more precise. A long-term law. First, it is important to be clear that the second fundamental law of capitalism, beta equals S divided by G, is applicable only if certain crucial assumptions are satisfied. First, this is an asymptotic law, meaning that it is valid only in the long run. If a country saves a proportion, S, of its income indefinitely, and if the rate of growth of its national income is G permanently, then its capital income ratio will tend closer and closer to beta equals S divided by G and stabilize at that level. This won't happen in a day, however. If a country saves a proportion S of its income for only a few years, it will not be enough to achieve a capital income ratio of beta equals S divided by G. For example, if a country starts with zero capital and saves 12% of its national income for a year, it obviously will not accumulate a capital stock worth 6 years of its income. With a savings rate of 12% a year, starting from zero capital, it will take 50 years to save the equivalent of 6 years of income. And even then, the capital income ratio will not be equal to 6. Because national income will itself have increased considerably after half a century, unless we assume that the growth rate is actually zero. The first principle to bear in mind is, therefore, that the accumulation of wealth takes time. It will take several decades for the law beta equals S divided by G to become true. Now we can understand why it took so much time for the shocks of 1914 to 1945 to fade away, and why it is so important to take a very long historical view when studying these questions. At the individual level, fortunes are sometimes amassed very quickly, but at the country level, the movement of the capital income ratio described by the law, beta equals S divided by G, is a long-run phenomenon. Hence, there is a crucial difference between this law and the law alpha equals R times beta, which I called the first fundamental law of capitalism, in Chapter 1. According to that law, the share of capital income in national income, alpha, is equal to the average rate of return on capital, R, times the capital income ratio, beta. It is important to realize that the law alpha equals R times beta is actually a pure accounting identity, valid at all times and all places by construction. Indeed, one can view it as a definition of the share of capital in national income, or of the rate of return on capital, depending on which parameter is easiest to measure, rather than as a law. By contrast, the law beta equals S divided by G is the result of a dynamic process. It represents a state of equilibrium toward which an economy will tend if the savings rate is S and the growth rate G. But that equilibrium state is never perfectly realized in practice. Second, the law beta equals S divided by G is valid only if one focuses on those forms of capital that human beings can accumulate. If a significant fraction of national capital consists of pure natural resources, that is, natural resources whose value is independent of any human improvement and any past investment, then beta can be quite high without any contribution from savings. I will say more later about the practical importance of non-accumulable capital. Finally, the law beta equals S divided by G is valid only if asset prices evolve on average in the same way as consumer prices. If the price of real estate or stocks rises faster than other prices, then the ratio beta between the market value of national capital and the annual flow of national income can again be quite high without the addition of any new savings. In the short run, variations, capital gains or losses of relative asset prices, that is, of asset prices relative to consumer prices, are often quite a bit larger than volume effects, that is, effects linked to new savings. If we assume, however, that price variations balance out over the long run, then the law beta equals S divided by G is necessarily valid, regardless of the reasons why the country in question chooses to save a proportion S of its national income. This point bears emphasizing. The law beta equals S divided by G is totally independent of the reasons why the residents of a particular country, or their government, accumulate wealth. In practice, people accumulate capital for all sorts of reasons. For instance, to increase future consumption, or to avoid a decrease in consumption after retirement, or to amass or preserve wealth for the next generation. Or again, to acquire the power, security, or prestige that often come with wealth. In general, all these motivations are present at once in proportions that vary with the individual, the country, and the age. Quite often, all these motivations are combined in single individuals, and individuals themselves may not always be able to articulate them clearly. In Part 3, I discuss in depth the significant implications of these various motivations and mechanisms of accumulation for inequality and the distribution of wealth, the role of inheritance in the structure of inequality, and more generally, the social, moral, and political justification of disparities in wealth. At this stage, I am simply explaining the dynamics of the capital-income ratio, a question that can be studied, at least initially, independently of the question of how wealth is distributed. The point I want to stress is that the law beta equals S divided by G applies in all cases, regardless of the exact reasons for a country's savings rate. This is due to the simple fact that beta equals S divided by G is the only stable capital income ratio in a country that saves a fraction, S, of its income, which grows at a rate, G. The argument is elementary. Let me illustrate it with an example. In concrete terms, if a country is saving 12% of its income every year, and if its initial capital stock is equal to 6 years of income, then the capital stock will grow at 2% a year, thus at exactly the same rate as national income, so that the capital-income ratio will remain stable. By contrast, if the capital stock is less than 6 years of income, then a savings rate of 12% will cause the capital stock to grow at a rate greater than 2% a year, and therefore faster than income, so that the capital-income ratio will increase until it attains its equilibrium level. Conversely, if the capital stock is greater than 6 years of annual income, then a savings rate of 12% implies that capital is growing at less than 2% a year, so that the capital income ratio cannot be maintained at that level and will therefore decrease until it reaches equilibrium. In each case, the capital income ratio tends over the long run toward its equilibrium level, beta equals S divided by G, possibly augmented by pure natural resources, provided that the average price of assets evolves at the same rate as consumption prices over the long run. To sum up, the law beta equals S divided by G does not explain the short-term shocks to which the capital income ratio is subject, any more than it explains the existence of world wars or the crisis of 1929, events that can be taken as examples of extreme shocks. But it does allow us to understand the potential equilibrium level toward which the capital income ratio tends in the long run when the effects of shocks and crises have dissipated. Capital's comeback in rich countries since the 1970s. In order to illustrate the difference between short-term and long-term movements of the capital income ratio, it is useful to examine the annual changes observed in the wealthiest countries between 1970 and 2010, a period for which we have reliable and homogeneous data for a large number of countries. To begin, here is a look at the ratio of private capital to national income, whose evolution is shown in PDF Figure 5.3 for the 8 richest countries in the world, in order of decreasing GDP. The United States, Japan, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Canada, and Australia. Compared with PDF Figures 5.1 and 5.2, as well as with the figures that accompanied previous chapters, which presented decennial averages in order to focus attention on long-term trends, PDF Figure 5.3 displays annual series and shows that the capital income ratio in all countries varied constantly in the very short run. These erratic changes are due to the fact that the prices of real estate, including housing and business real estate, and financial assets, especially shares of stock, are notoriously volatile. It is always very difficult to set a price on capital, in part because it is objectively complex to foresee the future demand for the goods and services generated by a firm or by real estate, and therefore to predict the future flows of profit, dividends, royalties, rents, and so on that the assets in question will yield, and in part because the present value of a building or corporation depends not only on these fundamental factors, but also on the price at which one can hope to sell these assets if the need arises, that is, on the anticipated capital gain or loss. Indeed, these anticipated future prices themselves depend on the general enthusiasm for a given type of asset, which can give rise to so-called self-fulfilling beliefs. As long as one can hope to sell an asset for more than one paid for it, it may be individually rational to pay a good deal more than the fundamental value of that asset, especially since the fundamental value is itself uncertain. Thus, giving in to the general enthusiasm for that type of asset, even though it may be excessive. That is why speculative bubbles in real estate and stocks have existed as long as capital itself. They are consubstantial with its history. As it happens, the most spectacular bubble in the period 1970 to 2010 was surely the Japanese bubble of 1990. See PDF Figure 5.3. During the 1980s, the value of private wealth shot up in Japan from slightly more than 4 years of national income at the beginning of the decade to nearly 7 at the end. Clearly, this enormous and extremely rapid increase was partly artificial. The value of private capital fell sharply in the early 1990s before stabilizing at around 6 years of national income from the mid-1990s on. I will not rehearse the history of the numerous real estate and stock market bubbles that inflated and burst in the rich countries after 1970, nor will I attempt to predict future bubbles, which I am quite incapable of doing in any case. Note, however, the sharp correction in the Italian real estate market in 1994 to 1995 and the bursting of the internet bubble in 2000 to 2001. which caused a particularly sharp drop in the capital income ratio in the United States and Britain, though not as sharp as the drop in Japan 10 years earlier. Note, too, that the subsequent U.S. real estate and stock market boom continued until 2007, followed by a deep drop in the recession of 2008 to 2009. In 2 years, U.S. private fortunes shrank from 5 to 4 years of national income, a drop of roughly the same size as the Japanese correction of 1991 to 1992. In other countries, and particularly in Europe, the correction was less severe or even non-existent. In Britain, France, and Italy, the price of assets, especially in real estate, briefly stabilized in 2008 before starting upward again in 2009 to 2010. So that by the early 2010s, private wealth had returned to the level attained in 2007, if not slightly higher. The important point I want to emphasize is that beyond these erratic and unpredictable variations in short-term asset prices, variations whose amplitude seems to have increased in recent decades, and we will see later that this can be related to the increase in the potential capital income ratio, there is indeed a long-term trend at work in all of the rich countries in the period 1970 to 2010. See PDF Figure 5.3. At the beginning of the 1970s, the total value of private wealth, net of debt, stood between 2 and 3.5 years of national income in all the rich countries on all continents. 40 years later, in 2010, private wealth represented between 4 and 7 years of national income in all the countries under study. The general evolution is clear. Bubbles aside, what we are witnessing is a strong comeback of private capital in the rich countries since 1970. Or, to put it another way, the emergence of a new patrimonial capitalism. This structural evolution is explained by three sets of factors, which complement and reinforce one another to give the phenomenon a very significant amplitude. The most important factor in the long run is slower growth, especially demographic growth, which, together with a high rate of saving, automatically gives rise to a structural increase in the long-run capital income ratio, owing to the law, beta equals S divided by G. This mechanism is the dominant force in the very long run, but should not be allowed to obscure the two other factors that have substantially reinforced its effects over the last few decades. First, the gradual privatization and transfer of public wealth into private hands in the 1970s and 1980s. And second, a long-term catch-up phenomenon affecting real estate and stock market prices, which also accelerated in the 1980s and 1990s in a political context that was on the whole more favorable to private wealth than that of the immediate post-war decades. Beyond bubbles, low growth, high saving. I begin with the first mechanism based on slower growth coupled with continued high saving and the dynamic law, beta equals S divided by G. In PDF Table 5.1, I have indicated the average values of the growth rates and private savings rates in the 8 richest countries during the period 1970 to 2010. As noted in Chapter 2, the rate of growth of per capita national income, or the virtually identical growth rate of per capita domestic product, has been quite similar in all the developed countries over the last few decades. If comparisons are made over periods of a few years, the differences can be significant, and these often spur national pride or jealousy. But if one takes averages over longer periods, the fact is that all the rich countries are growing at approximately the same rate. Between 1970 and 2010, the average annual rate of growth of per capita national income ranged from 1.6 to 2.0% in the 8 most developed countries, and more often than not remained between 1.7 and 1.9%. Given the imperfections of the available statistical measures, especially price indices, it is by no means certain that such small differences are statistically significant. In any case, these differences are very small compared with differences in the demographic growth rate. In the period 1970 to 2010, population grew at less than 0.5% per year in Europe and Japan, and closer to 0% in the period 1990 to 2010, or in Japan, even at a negative rate, compared with 1.0 to 1.5% in the United States, Canada, and Australia. See PDF Table 5.1. Hence, the overall growth rate for the period 1970 to 2010 was significantly higher in the United States and the other new countries than in Europe or Japan, around 3% a year in the former, or perhaps even a bit more, compared with barely 2% in the latter, or even just barely 1.5% in the most recent sub-period. Such differences may seem small, but over the long run they mount up, so that in fact they are quite significant. The new point I want to stress here is that such differences in growth rates have enormous effects on the long-run accumulation of capital and largely explain why the capital-income ratio is structurally higher in Europe and Japan than in the United States. Turning now to average savings rates in the period 1970 to 2010, again, one finds large variations between countries. The private savings rate generally ranges between 10 and 12% of national income, but it is as low as 7 to 8% in the United States and Britain, and as high as 14 to 15% in Japan and Italy. See PDF Table 5.1. Over 40 years, these differences mount up to create significant variation. Note, too, that the countries that save the most are often those whose population is stagnant and aging, which may justify saving for the purpose of retirement and bequest. But the relation is far from systematic. As noted, there are many reasons why one might choose to save more or less, and it comes as no surprise that many factors, linked to, among other things, culture, perceptions of the future, and distinctive national histories, come into play, just as they do in regard to decisions concerning childbearing and immigration, which ultimately help to determine the demographic growth rate. If one now combines variations in growth rates with variations in savings rate, it is easy to explain why different countries accumulate very different quantities of capital, and why the capital-income ratio has risen sharply since 1970. One particularly clear case is that of Japan, with a savings rate close to 15% a year and a growth rate barely above 2%. It is hardly surprising that Japan has over the long run accumulated a capital stock worth 6 to 7 years of national income. This is an automatic consequence of the dynamic law of accumulation, beta equals S divided by G. Similarly, it is not surprising that the United States, which saves much less than Japan and is growing faster, has a significantly lower capital-to-income ratio. More generally, if one compares the level of private wealth in 2010, predicted by the savings flows observed between 1970 and 2010, together with the initial wealth observed in 1970, with the actual observed levels of wealth in 2010, one finds that the two numbers are quite similar for most countries. The correspondence is not perfect, which shows that other factors also play a significant role. For instance, in the British case, the flow of savings seems quite inadequate to explain the very steep rise in private wealth in this period. Looking beyond the particular circumstances of this or that country, however, the results are overall quite consistent. It is possible to explain the main features of private capital accumulation in the rich countries between 1970 and 2010 in terms of the quantity of savings between those two dates, along with the initial capital endowment, without assuming a significant structural increase in the relative price of assets. In other words, movements in real estate and stock market prices always dominate in the short and even medium run, but tend to balance out over the long run, where volume effects appear generally to be decisive. Once again, the Japanese case is emblematic. If one tries to understand the enormous increase in the capital-income ratio in the 1980s and the sharp drop in the early 1990s, it is clear that the dominant phenomenon was the formation of a bubble in real estate and stocks, which then collapsed. But if one seeks to understand the evolution observed over the entire period, 1970 to 2010, it is clear that volume effects outweighed price effects. The fact that private wealth in Japan rose from 3 years of national income in 1970 to six in 2010 is predicted almost perfectly by the flow of savings. The two components of private saving. For the sake of completeness, I should make clear that private saving consists of two components. Savings made directly by private individuals. This is the part of disposable household income that is not consumed immediately. And savings by firms on behalf of the private individuals who own them, directly in the case of individual firms or indirectly via their financial investments. This second component consists of profits reinvested by firms, also referred to as retained earnings, and in some countries accounts for as much as half the total amount of private savings. See PDF Table 5.2. If one were to ignore this second component of savings and consider only household savings, strictly defined, one would conclude that savings flows in all countries are clearly insufficient to account for the growth of private wealth, which one would then explain largely in terms of a structural increase in the relative price of assets, especially shares of stock. Such a conclusion would be correct in accounting terms, but artificial in economic terms. It is true that stock prices tend to rise more quickly than consumption prices over the long run. But the reason for this is essentially that retained earnings allow firms to increase their size and capital, so that we are looking at a volume effect rather than a price effect. If retained earnings are included in private savings, however, the price effect largely disappears. In practice, from the standpoint of shareholders, profits paid out directly as dividends are often more heavily taxed than retained earnings. Hence, it may be advantageous for the owners of capital to pay only a limited share of profits as dividends to meet their immediate consumption needs and leave the rest to accumulate and be reinvested in the firm and its subsidiaries. Later, some shares can be sold in order to realize the capital gains, which are generally taxed less heavily than dividends. The variation between countries with respect to the proportion of retained earnings in total private savings can be explained, moreover, largely by differences in legal and tax systems. These are accounting differences rather than actual economic differences. Under these conditions, it is better to treat retained earnings as savings realized on behalf of the firm's owners, and therefore as a component of private saving. I should also be clear that the notion of savings relevant to the dynamic law, beta equals S divided by G, is savings net of capital depreciation, that is, truly new savings, or the part of total savings left over after we deduct the amount needed to compensate for wear and tear on buildings and equipment, to repair a hole in the roof or a pipe, or to replace a worn-out automobile, computer, machine, or what have you. The difference is important because annual capital depreciation in the developed economies is on the order of 10 to 15% of national income and absorbs nearly half of total savings, which generally run around 25 to 30% of national income, leaving net savings of 10 to 15% of national income. See PDF Table 5.3. In particular, the bulk of retained earnings often goes to maintaining buildings and equipment, and frequently, the amount left over to finance net investment is quite small, at most a few percent of national income, or even negative if retained earnings are insufficient to cover the depreciation of capital. By definition, only net savings can increase the capital stock. Savings used to cover depreciation simply ensure that the existing capital stock will not decrease. Durable goods and valuables. Finally, I want to make it clear that private saving, as defined here, and therefore private wealth, does not include household purchases of durable goods. furniture, appliances, automobiles, and so on. In this respect, I am following international standards for national accounting, under which durable household goods are treated as items of immediate consumption, although the same goods, when purchased by firms, are counted as investments with a high rate of annual depreciation. This is of limited importance for my purposes, however, because durable goods have always represented a relatively small proportion of total wealth, which has not varied much over time. In all rich countries, available estimates indicate that the total value of durable household goods is generally between 30% and 50% of national income throughout the period 1970 to 2010, with no apparent trend. In other words, everyone owns on average between a third and half a year's income worth of furniture, refrigerators, cars, and so on, or 10,000 to 15,000 euros per capita for a national income on the order of 30,000 euros per capita in the early 2010s. This is not a negligible amount, and accounts for most of the wealth owned by a large segment of the population. Compared, however, with overall private wealth of 5 to 6 years of national income, or 150,000 to 200,000 euros per person, excluding durable goods, about half of which is in the form of real estate and half in net financial assets, bank deposits, stocks, bonds, and other investments, net of debt and business capital, this is only a small supplementary amount. Concretely, if we were to include durable goods in private wealth, the only effect would be to add 30 to 50% of national income to the curves shown in PDF Figure 5.3, without significantly modifying the overall evolution. Note in passing that apart from real estate and business capital, the only non-financial assets included in national accounts under international standards, which I have followed scrupulously in order to ensure consistency in my comparisons of private and national wealth between countries, are valuables, including items such as works of art, jewelry, and precious metals such as gold and silver, which households acquire as a pure reservoir of value, or for their aesthetic value, and which in principle do not deteriorate, or deteriorate very little over time. These valuables are worth much less than durable goods by most estimates. However, between 5 and 10% of national income, depending on the country, or between 1,500 and 3,000 per person for a per capita national income of 30,000 euros. Hence, their share of total private wealth is relatively small, even after the recent rise in the price of gold. It is interesting to note that according to available historical estimates, these orders of magnitude do not seem to have changed much over the long run. Estimates of the value of durable goods are generally around 30 to 50% of national income for both the 19th and 20th centuries. Gregory King's estimates of British national wealth around 1700 show the same thing. The total value of furniture, china, and so on was about 30% of national income. The amount of wealth represented by valuables and precious objects seems to have decreased over the long run, however, from 10 to 15% of national income in the late 19th and early 20th century to 5 to 10% today. According to King, the total value of such goods, including metal coin, was as high as 25 to 30% of national income around 1700. In all cases, these are relatively limited amounts compared to total accumulated wealth in Britain of around 7 years of national income, primarily in the form of farmland, dwellings, and other capital goods, shops, factories, warehouses, livestock, ships, etc., at which King does not fail to rejoice and marvel. Private capital expressed in years of disposable income. Note, moreover, that the capital income ratio would have attained even higher levels, no doubt the highest ever recorded, in the rich countries in the 2000s and 2010s, if I had expressed total private wealth in terms of years of disposable income rather than national income, as I have done thus far. This seemingly technical issue warrants further discussion. As the name implies, disposable household income, or simply disposable income, measures the monetary income that households in a given country dispose of directly. To go from national income to disposable income, one must deduct all taxes, fees, and other obligatory payments and add all monetary transfers, pensions, unemployment insurance, aid to families, welfare payments, etc. Until the turn of the 20th century, governments played a limited role in social and economic life. Total tax payments were on the order of 10% of national income, which went essentially to pay for traditional state functions, such as police, army, courts, highways, and so on. So that disposable income was generally around 90% of national income. The state's role increased considerably over the course of the 20th century, so that disposable income today amounts to around 70 to 80% of national income in the rich countries. As a result, total private wealth expressed in years of disposable income, rather than national income, is significantly higher. For example, private capital in the 2000s represented 4 to 7 years of national income in the rich countries, which would correspond to 5 to 9 years of disposable income. See PDF Figure 5.4. Both ways of measuring the capital income ratio can be justified, depending on how one wants to approach the question. When expressed in terms of disposable income, the ratio emphasizes strictly monetary realities and shows us the magnitude of wealth in relation to the income actually available to households, to save, for instance. In a way, this reflects the concrete reality of the family bank account, and it is important to keep these orders of magnitude in mind. It is also important to note, however, that the gap between disposable income and national income measures by definition the value of public services from which households benefit, especially health and education services financed directly by the public treasury. Such transfers in kind are just as valuable as the monetary transfers included in disposable income. They allow the individuals concerned to avoid spending comparable or even greater sums on private producers of health and education services. Ignoring such transfers in kind might well distort certain evolutions or international comparisons. That is why it seemed to me preferable to express wealth in years of national income. To do so is to adopt an economic, rather than strictly monetary, view of income. In this book, whenever I refer to the capital income ratio without further qualification, I am always referring to the ratio of the capital stock to the flow of national income. The question of foundations and other holders of capital. Note also that for the sake of completeness, I have included in private wealth not only the assets and liabilities of private individuals, households, in national accounting terminology, but also assets and liabilities held by foundations and other non-profit organizations. To be clear, this category includes only foundations and other organizations financed primarily by gifts from private individuals or income from their properties. Organizations that depend primarily on public subsidies are classified as governmental organizations, and those that depend primarily on the sale of goods are classified as corporations. In practice, all of these distinctions are malleable and porous. It is rather arbitrary to count the wealth of foundations as part of private wealth rather than public wealth, or to place it in a category of its own, since it is in fact a novel form of ownership, intermediate between purely private and strictly public ownership. In practice, when we think of the property owned by churches over the centuries, or the property owned today by organizations such as Doctors Without Borders, or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, it is clear that we are dealing with a wide variety of moral persons pursuing a range of specific objectives. Note, however, that the stakes are relatively limited, since the amount of wealth owned by moral persons is generally rather small compared with what physical persons retain for themselves. Available estimates for the various rich countries in the period 1970 to 2010 show that foundations and other nonprofit organizations always own less than 10% and generally less than 5% of total private wealth, though with interesting variations between countries. Barely 1% in France, around 3-4% in Japan, and as much as 6-7% in the United States, with no apparent trend. Available historical sources indicate that the total value of church-owned property in 18th-century France amounted to about 7-8% of total private wealth, or approximately 50-60% of national income. Some of this property was confiscated and sold during the French Revolution to pay off debts incurred by the government of the Ancien Régime. In other words, the Catholic Church owned more property in Ancien Régime France, relative to the total private wealth of the era, than prosperous U.S. foundations own today. It is interesting to observe that the two levels are nevertheless fairly close. These are quite substantial holdings of wealth, especially if we compare them with the meager, and sometimes negative, net wealth owned by the government at various points in time. Compared with total private wealth, however, the wealth of foundations remains fairly modest. In particular, it matters little whether or not we include foundations when considering the general evolution of the ratio of private capital to national income over the long run. Inclusion is justified, moreover, by the fact that it is never easy to define the boundary line between, on the one hand, various legal structures such as foundations, trust funds, and the like used by wealthy individuals to manage their assets and further their private interests, which are in principle counted in national accounts as individual holdings, assuming they are identified as such, and on the other hand, foundations and nonprofits said to be in the public interest. I will come back to this delicate issue in Part 3, where I will discuss the dynamics of global inequality of wealth, and especially great wealth, in the 21st century. The privatization of wealth in the rich countries. The very sharp increase in private wealth observed in the rich countries, and especially in Europe and Japan, between 1970 and 2010, thus can be explained largely by slower growth coupled with continued high savings, using the law, beta equals S divided by G. I will now return to the two other complementary phenomena that amplified this mechanism, which I mentioned earlier, the privatization or gradual transfer of public wealth into private hands, and the catch-up of asset prices over the long run. I begin with privatization. As noted, the proportion of public capital in national capital has dropped sharply in recent decades, especially in France and Germany, where net public wealth represented as much as a quarter or even a third of total national wealth in the period 1950 to 1970. Whereas today it represents just a few percent. Public assets are just enough to balance public debt. This evolution reflects a quite general phenomenon that has affected all 8 leading developed economies. A gradual decrease in the ratio of public capital to national income in the period 1970 to 2010, accompanied by an increase in the ratio of private capital to national income. See PDF figure 5.5. In other words, the revival of private wealth is partly due to the privatization of national wealth. To be sure, the increase in private capital in all countries was greater than the decrease in public capital. So national capital, measured in years of national income, did indeed increase. But it increased less rapidly than private capital owing to privatization. The case of Italy is particularly clear. Net public wealth was slightly positive in the 1970s, then turned slightly negative in the 1980s. As large government deficits mounted. All told, public wealth decreased by an amount equal to nearly a year of national income over the period 1970 to 2010. At the same time, private wealth rose from barely 2.5 years of national income in 1970 to nearly 7 in 2010, an increase of roughly 4.5 years. In other words, the decrease in public wealth represented between 1/5 and 1/4 of the increase in private wealth, a non-negligible share. Italian national wealth did indeed rise significantly, from around 2.5 years of national income in 1970 to about 6 in 2010. But this was a smaller increase than in private wealth, whose exceptional growth was to some extent misleading, since nearly a quarter of it reflected a growing debt that one portion of the Italian population owed to another. Instead of paying taxes to balance the government's budget, the Italians, or at any rate those who had the means, lent money to the government by buying government bonds or public assets, which increased their private wealth without increasing the national wealth. Indeed, despite a very high rate of private saving, roughly 15% of national income, national saving in Italy was less than 10% of national income in the period 1970 to 2010. In other words, more than a third of private saving was absorbed by government deficits. A similar pattern exists in all the rich countries, but one generally less extreme than in Italy. In most countries, public saving was negative, which means that public investment was less than the public deficit. The government invested less than it borrowed, or used borrowed money to pay current expenses. In France, Britain, Germany, and the United States, government deficits exceeded public investment by 2 to 3% of national income on average over the period 1970 to 2010, compared with more than 6% in Italy. See PDF Table 5.4. In all the rich countries, public dissaving and the consequent decrease in public wealth accounted for a significant portion of the increase in private wealth, between one-tenth and one-quarter, depending on the country. This was not the primary reason for the increase in private wealth, but it should not be neglected. It is possible, moreover, that the available estimates somewhat undervalue public assets in the 1970s, especially in Britain, and perhaps Italy and France as well, which would lead us to underestimate the magnitude of the transfers of public wealth to private hands. If true, this would allow us to explain why British private wealth increased so much between 1970 and 2010, despite a clearly insufficient private savings rate, and in particular during the waves of privatizations of public firms in the 1980s and 1990s. Privatizations that often involved notoriously low prices, which of course guaranteed that the policy would be popular with buyers. It is important to note that these transfers of public sector wealth to the private sector were not limited to rich countries after 1970. Far from it. The same general pattern exists on all continents. At the global level, the most extensive privatization in recent decades, and indeed in the entire history of capital, obviously took place in the countries of the former Soviet bloc. The highly imperfect estimates available to us indicate that private wealth in Russia and the former Eastern Bloc countries stood at about 4 years of national income in the late 2000s and early 2010s. And net public wealth was extremely low, just as in the rich countries. Available estimates for the 1970s and 1980s, prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the communist regimes, are even more imperfect. But all signs are that the distribution was strictly the opposite. Private wealth was insignificant, limited to individual plots of land and perhaps some housing in the communist countries least averse to private property, but in all cases, less than a year's national income. And public capital represented the totality of industrial capital and the lion's share of national capital, amounting, as a first approximation, to between 3 and 4 years of national income. In other words, at first sight, the stock of national capital did not change, but the public-private split was totally reversed. To sum up, the very considerable growth of private wealth in Russia and Eastern Europe between the late 1980s and the present, which led in some cases to the spectacularly rapid enrichment of certain individuals, I am thinking mainly of the Russian oligarchs, obviously had nothing to do with saving or the dynamic law beta equals S divided by G. It was purely and simply the result of a transfer of ownership of capital from the government to private individuals. The privatization of national wealth in the developed countries since 1970 can be regarded as a very attenuated form of this extreme case. The historic rebound of asset prices. The last factor explaining the increase in the capital income ratio over the past few decades is the historic rebound of asset prices. In other words, no correct analysis of the period 1970 to 2010 is possible unless we situate this period in the longer historical context of 1910 to 2010. Complete historical records are not available for all developed countries, but the series I have established for Britain, France, Germany, and the United States yield consistent results, which I summarize below. If we look at the whole period 1910 to 2010, or 1870 to 2010, we find that the global evolution of the capital income ratio is very well explained by the dynamic law beta equals S divided by G. In particular, the fact that the capital income ratio is structurally higher over the long run in Europe than in the United States is perfectly consistent with the differences in the saving rate, and especially the growth rate over the past century. The decline we see in the period 1910 to 1950 is consistent with low national savings and wartime destruction, and the fact that the capital income ratio rose more rapidly between 1980 and 2010 than between 1950 and 1980 is well explained by the decrease in the growth rate between these two periods. Nevertheless, the low point of the 1950s was lower than the simple logic of accumulation summed up by the law beta equals S divided by G would have predicted. In order to understand the depth of the mid-20th century low, we need to add the fact that the price of real estate and stocks fell to historically low levels in the aftermath of World War II for any number of reasons: rent control laws, financial regulation, a political climate unfavorable to private capitalism. After 1950, these asset prices gradually recovered with an acceleration after 1980. According to my estimates, this historical catch-up process is now complete, leaving aside erratic short-term price movements. The increase in asset prices between 1950 and 2010 seems, broadly speaking, to have compensated for the decline between 1910 and 1950. It would be risky to conclude from this that the phase of structural asset price increases is definitely over, however, and that asset prices will henceforth progress at exactly the same pace as consumer prices. For one thing, the historical sources are incomplete and imperfect, and price comparisons over such long periods of time are approximate at best. For another, there are many theoretical reasons why asset prices may evolve differently from other prices over the long run. For example, some types of assets, such as buildings and infrastructure, are affected by technological progress at a rate different from those of other parts of the economy. Furthermore, the fact that certain natural resources are non-renewable can also be important. Last but not least, it is important to stress that the price of capital, leaving aside the perennial short- and medium-term bubbles and possible long-term structural divergences, is always in part a social and political construct. It reflects each society's notion of property and depends on the many policies and institutions that regulate relations among different social groups, and especially between those who own capital and those who do not. This is obvious, for example, in the case of real estate prices, which depend on laws regulating the relations between landlords and tenants and controlling rents. The law also affects stock market prices, as I noted when I discussed why stock prices in Germany are relatively low. In this connection, it is interesting to analyze the ratio between the stock market value and the accounting value of firms in the period 1970 to 2010, in those countries for which such data are available. See PDF Figure 5.6. Readers who find these issues too technical can easily skip over the remainder of this section and go directly to the next. The market value of a company listed on the stock exchange is its stock market capitalization. For companies not so listed, either because they are too small or because they choose not to finance themselves via the stock market, perhaps in order to preserve family ownership, which can happen even in very large firms, the market value is calculated for national accounting purposes with reference to observed stock prices for listed firms as similar as possible, in terms of size, sector of activity, and so on, to the unlisted firm, while taking into account the liquidity of the relevant market. Thus far, I have used market values to measure stocks of private wealth and national wealth. The accounting value of a firm, also called book value or net assets or own capital, is equal to the accumulated value of all assets, buildings, infrastructure, machinery, patents, majority or minority stakes in subsidiaries and other firms, vault cash, and so on, included in the firm's balance sheet, less the total of all outstanding debt. In theory, in the absence of all uncertainty, the market value and book value of a firm should be the same, and the ratio of the two should therefore be equal to 1, or 100%. This is normally the case when a company is created. If the shareholders subscribe to 100 million euros worth of shares, which the firm uses to buy offices and equipment worth 100 million euros, then the market value and book value will both be equal to 100 million euros. The same is true if the firm borrows 50 million euros to buy new machinery worth 50 million euros. The net asset value will still be 100 million euros, 150 million in assets minus 50 million in debt, as will the stock market capitalization. The same will be true if the firm earns 50 million in profits and decides to create a reserve to finance new investments worth 50 million. The stock price will rise by the same amount, because everyone knows that the firm has new assets, so that both the market value and the book value will increase to 150 million. The difficulty arises from the fact that anticipating the future of the firm quickly becomes more complex and uncertain. After a certain time, for example, no one is really sure whether the investment of 50 million euros several years earlier is really economically useful to the firm. The book value may then diverge from the market value. The firm will continue to list investments in new offices, machinery, infrastructure, patents, and so on its balance sheet at their market value, so the book value of the firm remains unchanged. The market value of the firm, that is, its stock market capitalization, may be significantly lower or higher, depending on whether financial markets have suddenly become more optimistic or pessimistic about the firm's ability to use its investments to generate new business and profits. That is why, in practice, one always observes enormous variations in the ratio of the market value to the book value of individual firms. This ratio, which is also known as Tobin's Q, for the economist James Tobin, who was the first to define it, varied from barely 20% to more than 340% for French firms listed in the CAC 40 in 2012. It is more difficult to understand why Tobin's Q, when measured for all firms in a given country taken together, should be systematically greater or smaller than one. Classically, two explanations have been given. If certain immaterial investments, such as expenditures to increase the value of a brand, or for research and development, are not counted on the balance sheet, then it is logical for the market value to be structurally greater than the book value. This may explain the ratios slightly greater than 1 observed in the United States, 100 to 120%, and especially Britain, 120 to 140%, in the late 1990s and 2000s. But these ratios greater than 1 also reflect stock market bubbles in both countries. Tobin's Q fell rapidly toward 1 when the internet bubble burst in 2001 to 2002 and in the financial crisis of 2008 to 2009. See PDF figure 5.6. Conversely, if the stockholders of a company do not have full control, say, because they have to compromise in a long-term relationship with other stakeholders, such as worker representatives, local or national governments, consumer groups, and so on, as we saw earlier is the case in Rhenish capitalism, then it is logical that the market value should be structurally less than the book value. This may explain the ratios slightly below one observed in France, around 80%, and especially Germany and Japan, around 50 to 70% in the 1990s and 2000s, when English and U.S. firms were at or above 100%. See PDF figure 5.6. Note, too, that stock market capitalization is calculated on the basis of prices observed in current stock transactions, which generally correspond to buyers seeking small minority positions, and not buyers seeking to take control of the firm. In the latter case, it is common to pay a price significantly higher than the current market price, typically on the order of 20% higher. This difference may be enough to explain a Tobin's Q of around 80%, even when there are no stakeholders other than minority shareholders. Leaving aside these interesting international variations, which reflect the fact that the price of capital always depends on national rules and institutions, one can note a general tendency for Tobin's Q to increase in the rich countries since 1970. This is a consequence of the historic rebound of asset prices. All told, if we take account of both higher stock prices and higher real estate prices, we can say that the rebound in asset prices accounts for 1/4 to 1/3 of the increase in the ratio of national capital to national income in the rich countries between 1970 and 2010, with large variations between countries. National capital and net foreign assets in the rich countries. As noted, the enormous amounts of foreign assets held by the rich countries, especially Britain and France on the eve of World War I, totally disappeared following the shocks of 1914 to 1945, and net foreign asset positions have never returned to their previous high levels. In fact, if we look at the levels of national capital and net foreign capital in the rich countries between 1970 and 2010, it is tempting to conclude that foreign assets were of limited importance. The net foreign asset position is sometimes slightly positive and sometimes slightly negative, depending on the country and the year, but the balance is generally fairly small compared with total national capital. In other words, the sharp increase in the level of national capital in the rich countries reflects mainly the increase of domestic capital, and to a first approximation, net foreign assets would seem to have played only a relatively minor role. See PDF figure 5.7. This conclusion is not quite accurate, however. For example, Japan and Germany have accumulated quite significant quantities of net foreign assets over the past few decades, especially in the 2000s, largely as an automatic consequence of their trade surpluses. In the early 2010s, Japan's net foreign assets totaled about 70% of national income, and Germany's amounted to nearly